Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Welcome back. You are listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. I am Carrie Weber, along with Father Matt Malone, and we are talking with Kevin Clark, our friend and colleague, about how Catholics should approach this ISIS threat and international relations. And we want to hear from you. We want to hear your thoughts on this topic. You can call us at 888-322-8465. That's 888-3-Catholic. Now, Kevin, ISIS has managed to use social media quite effectively in terms of recruiting and even recruiting people from foreign nations. What do you have to say about the way that they've used this?
Well, I guess it's the internet is a great gift, as even the Pope Francis has said, but it can also be used in ways that are frightening. The early videos, I guess, that emerged from Al-Qaeda were considered almost laughably amateurish. I don't know how that pertains really when you're dealing with terrorist organizations. If people are really worried about Hollywood production values. But ISIS has really, and perhaps because they have so much help from Westerners, from Britain, and even people from the United States are joining up, traveling to Syria and joining the movement, they have taken a much more sophisticated, from a technology, from a graphic arts perspective, approach on their video projects. And to the extent that reaches people more effectively, it's a real concern. And they do seem to have, they have a very active front, if you will, on Twitter, which they take advantage of, reaching more and more people. The CIA initially estimated their numbers at no more than around 7,000. Well, they came out with a new estimate this week, and it's quite troubling. They're saying ISIS could be as large as 21 to 31,000. They don't really know, it sounds right. like.
I think that's the bottom line. They don't really know. Yeah. And of course, their presence on YouTube has been quite effective from their point of view. I mean, these videos, these horrific videos of the beheadings of journalists and others have really galvanized people in the United States and in the West and motivated them to engage this threat and want to engage this threat probably before we really even have a good idea of how to do so.
And that's a good question. How big a threat really is ISIS to the United States right. and to the West? We are making a very dramatic commitment through air power. We heard this week from General Martin Dempsey, the Joint Chairman of the Joint right. Chiefs of Staff, who said if the air power doesn't work, he thinks troops will have to return to Iraq. And this was a bit of a shock to folks because
it's ahead of the president, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not clear if they're coordinating messages, if mm-hmm. there's some problem there, or if he's saying the things the president wants to say but is reluctant to say.
Okay. And
is the country really ready to send its young men and women back into Iraq? I mean, they're there already. There's about 1,600 advisors on the ground right now, but it's possible we'll have a more meaningful recommitment to the region.
These are huge questions, and we invite you to join the conversation at 1-888-322-8465. That's 888-3-Catholic. Mike from North Carolina, you are on the air with America This Week. Hello, Mike. We apparently have lost Mike. but I think that one of the things that Mike was going to tell us is something that a lot of Americans have been saying, and that is that we really do need to step up our response. I think there's a sense among Americans that this is a major threat.
Yeah, but I wonder, is it because it's a visceral reaction to the beheading of journalist James Foley and Stephen Sutloff, and then now the gentleman from Great Britain who was recently executed by these guys? which is a horrible, horrible event, horrible images. But in terms of their legitimate, their existential threat to the United States, I'm not sure if we're reacting appropriately. Maybe, perhaps we're overreacting to this group. They certainly are an existential threat to specific communities in the region, the Yazidis and the Christian minorities of that region who are now essentially in flight from ISIS. But do they really muster, could they muster enough comprehensive attack on the United States? It's a concern that there might be some fear-mongering out there going on.
Right. How do we get a better sense of that? Because in order to respond appropriately, we have to have this appropriate sense of what their powers are and where we stand and what we can do that's effective. But how do we get there?
Well, I think I would follow the old maxim, don't just do something, stand there. We tend to go the other way sometimes. And let's remember that that's possibly what contributed to us getting so disastrously involved in this region in the first place. You know, now we have members of Congress talking about ISIS threat from the Mexico border without any clear evidence of such a threat. So it is possible to make a misstep here because of a sense of urgency that is perhaps exactly what ISIS, you know, you have to wonder, why did they release those videos? Are they trying to draw us in? They certainly were effective recruitment tools for militants from the West and from the region. But are they playing a long game here that we don't quite understand quite yet? And
well, there's also, I think it's pretty clear that this group is looking for a kind of apocalyptic showdown with, you know, the world's, with the world.
Yeah.
Right. And so in what way are we actually playing into their hands with such an aggressive and dramatic response? We have Karen from New Orleans on the air with America This Week. Hello, Karen.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Our pleasure. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, Kevin, why do you think people from the West, like from the United States, from England, are joining ISIS? Do you think they think it's a game and, oh, we're going to try this a little while, and then they get there and find out they can't come home? Or
I think that is actually the case for some who have returned to Great Britain, went there because they thought they were going to fight against Assad, and have returned disillusioned because they found themselves in a fight against, as they termed it, fellow Muslims. A lot of these are young men who have converted to Islam. You know, I can't really speak to their specific cases. You know, I'm sure there's varying degrees of actual religious conversion taking place. Maybe there's just young people who are disaffected, unsure how to proceed. And, you know, and there's a certain heroic glamour to giving your life to a cause that I think a lot of young men always and young women are drawn to. But there are stories of men coming back who fought for ISIS and were quickly disillusioned in what they were trapped in, caught up in. And some of the prisoners taken by the Peshmerga have said the same, that some have even just said, look, they offered $150 a day. We were in a situation where there was no work either in Syria or in Iraq, earning $2 or $3 a day. So some people are doing it purely for the cash. And unfortunately, ISIS has a lot of cash. They stole something in the area of a half a billion American dollars from banks in Mosul when they conquered that city. And they are also drawing income from oil sales.
Karen, do you know of stories in your own area where you are of people who have joined the ISIS effort?
No, I don't. I just was reading a story on Facebook this morning, or in the paper, I think, of two young girls from, they weren't from this area, but they disappeared, and when the father found them, they were in, they had gone to join ISIS. And I think they thought they were going to be able to come home, and then they got there, and one's disappeared, and the other one, they don't know what's going on with her. So I was just curious.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for calling America This Week. It really is amazing how this topic has penetrated the conversation in this country. And it's everywhere. People are seeing it on Facebook. They're reading about it in their local papers. And it it didn't even seem to be something that most people were aware of just a few months ago.
Well, I think we all got a little complacent. We had withdrawn from Iraq. It seemed like the government, I don't think the general public was paying a great deal of attention to what the Maliki government was doing in Iraq after the withdrawal of the United States. But, you know, the Shiite-dominated government there was engaging in, by some estimates, acts of suppression of the Sunni community throughout the country. They were purging the government of Sunnis. They were clamping down on protests. There was a lot of grievances emerging. In fact, some of the people who are now supporting ISIS were the same people we were able to draw away from al-Qaeda with the awakening movement. Now they've turned around and they're going back to supporting ISIS as the lesser of two evils here.
Right, right.
Perhaps to some of their regret at this point, because I don't think even the people who are joining, the local people who are supporting ISIS quite realized what they were getting into when ISIS came in and the storm of violence that has followed their path.
And what do you think is the—and the United States and the West are also going to face a choice between and among evils, right? I mean—
There's no good way through this. I find myself wondering if we have the patience. You know, people here, we want this to be fixed in, by the next election cycle, a year from now, 6 months from now. We could be looking at something here that could last for decades. I mean, this could be the 30 years war of the Middle East.
Right.
Are we on board for that? And this is something that David Courtwright was talking about. You know, we need to understand the ramifications and the complexity of the region before we get further involved. He cautioned that, the Catholic just war teaching would still encourage the use of force to an imminent threat. But as he put it, dropping bombs as a policy is not an acceptable option.
Right. And that's a very interesting point that you bring up about Catholic just war theory, which has been for centuries the traditional way in which we as Catholics frame our decision making about these matters. Of course, it kind of presupposes the existence of state actors. And there are some people who are saying, is this an adequate framework for assessing this situation from the Catholic point of view? What do you think about what are the criteria in addition to the just war tradition that we can bring to bear on questions like this?
Well, I think we at the bare minimum we can say there has been an emerging international understanding of something called the responsibility to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And that responsibility would say, at the very minimum, with the international
Pope
community,
Benedict endorsed that at the United Nations
during
his visit to New York.
Yes, and I believe Pope Francis has supported it as well. The bare minimum that the international community is required to do is intervene when gross humanitarian disasters are occurring or crimes against humanity or war crimes. Mm. Now, it's hard to parse something like an attack on a minority religious community like the Yazidi being driven from their homes in flight for their lives as anything but a war crime. These people were unarmed. They were defenseless. The Iraqi army fell apart as ISIS mm-hmm. approached. In that specific case, you would say that we do have a responsibility to respond with military force if necessary. But David Courtwright would say, if that's the extent of our approach, if we don't have a multilateral diplomatic front going on, if we don't have we're not looking at economic sanctions, if we're not looking at talking to people, negotiating with people we might consider our enemies, people in Iran, for instance, even perhaps people within the Assad regime, we're not going to succeed.
And again, thinking about our limitations, the limitations that the U.S. and the West have in responding to this threat, we also have to keep in mind the other crises that the world is dealing with right now. One of the things that Carrie and I have been talking about and we've been discussing at the editorial conference is the Ebola threat in Africa. And that in and of itself at any other time would be a major international crisis that would require all of our resources.
It's something that we're trying to respond to as we try to respond to all of these other issues in the world and trying to figure out where our resources go and what is the best use of those resources. And the U.S. has recently sort of stepped up its game in responding to the Ebola crisis, which is, I think, in response to this idea that there is a small window of opportunity before this Ebola crisis in West Africa becomes a global Ebola crisis that is really beyond what we have the ability to sort of manage in some ways. And so the U.S. is committed to building I think 17 hospitals with 100 beds each for Ebola patients, and in Liberia, and there they still say that they still need about 1,000 beds next week. That even that is
not just in Liberia.
Yeah,
there's other countries in West Africa that are being significantly affected
by
Ebola.
This
is another case where the world community is once again looking to the United States to respond. And the president did respond this week. They're sending 3,000 troops, mm-hmm. American soldiers, to combat this disease and pulling together resources to fight it. The UN is estimating it might cost something in the area of $1 billion to try to stem this epidemic before it gets much worse. And I think, you know, as in confronting something like ISIS, you're confronting this disease, this virus. As you know, ISIS is a thought virus, I guess you could say. Ebola is an actual virus. What happened to all these multilateral framework that we've come to rely upon? Why did it not? Why wasn't there a more significant effort made at the beginning? And I don't want to beat up on the World Health Organization because I think they were completely overwhelmed by this
and under resourced,
and perhaps under resourced. And that's sort of the question for the world community: do we have? You know, we seem to still be in a reactive mode with this virus as it gets larger and larger. And let's bear in mind, it is killing anywhere between, depending on who it's hit, what community it's hit, 50 to 90% of its victims are dying from Ebola. So this is if this virus goes airborne, as this is a great fear now, if it mutates to an airborne virus, this could be a major threat to the world, which is why
it could be a global pandemic. It could be a much greater threat than ISIS.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the challenges is assessing the situation, knowing what resources are appropriate for our response. And I know one of the things that the U.S. has offered is kits to families who will have to handle dead bodies of family members killed by Ebola. But those family members need to know how to use those kits so as not to put themselves into greater danger.
Yeah.
There's an education element involved in that as well. We can't just send something and then say good luck.
Yeah, the worst case scenario here would be dropping a pallet of gear into the bush of West Africa and saying good luck. We'll check in with you in a few months because...
Right.
As you say, Carrie, the education level is not there. People are not going to be able to, you know, pick these kits up and put them to use. Some health workers are actually concerned that these kits could be counterproductive, that people will use them the wrong way, maybe perhaps overconfidently go into these situations and further endanger themselves.
It is difficult at times to not feel overwhelmed by all of the bad news. But the good news is that there are thousands and thousands of people who are good-natured and good-hearted and are trying to respond to these crises. And one of the things that we try to do at America in our international coverage, but throughout our pages, is to encourage their work. And
we should make note of Caritas and Catholic Relief Services, two organizations from the church that remain active in that region.
And you can support in any number of ways by checking them out on their websites. You're listening to America This Week. I am Father Matt Malone. I'm joined by Carrie Weber. I'd like to thank our senior editor and chief correspondent, Kevin Clark, for being with us today to talk about the international situation.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.